Avenues and boulevards, lanes and arterials, highways and streets, crisscrossing our neighborhoods, intersecting our cities, knitting our communities together. All public, open to everyone, home to the daily theater of the street. Historically, the realm of the pedestrian and the rider, the horse-drawn carriage, the jitney, the streetcar. At the turn of the 20th century, these rights of way separated property, protected public space, rationalized our city's gridwork of streets and lots, directing future development, and reserving transportation lines.
But over the last 50 years, one player has taken the lead role on this stage, stealing the limelight and relegating its predecessors to bit roles. Fords and Chevys, Peugeots and Hondas, Toyotas and Audis, the rise of the almighty automobile. The perfect vehicle for another love affair. The Western world's obsession with suburbia.
There's another actor in the playhouse, vying for a spot on the roll call list. A group that rejects four wheels in favor of two. Bicycle riders. They're looking to rewrite the script, making a play for space on our rights of way, and challenging our vehicular values. They argue sustainability and affordability, efficiency and densification, cycle paths and livable neighborhoods. But in the zero-sum game of street space, the old guard isn't about to give in so easily. Not to these upstarts. More space for bikes means less space for cars.
It's not easy as a newcomer to wrestle the spotlight from the headliner. There are no easy concessions, and plenty of bad blood in the clash, playing out daily in our public spaces.
In this episode, we explore road wars.
I'm Ross Howard.
And I'm Danielle Davis.
And this is Cities Alive, bringing the city to life with stories.
Roads are built for buses, cars, and trucks, not for people on bikes. And what I compare bike lanes to is swimming with the sharks. Sooner or later, you're going to get bitten.
And the number one thing people yell at me is, get on the sidewalk, which I think is hilarious because, you know, that's actually, like, I'm riding legally, and what they're asking me to do is something illegal. Why don't those car drivers just follow the rules and go when they're supposed to go?
Well, I'm definitely not a fan of the cyclists actually in Hamilton. Honestly, like the way that I learned how to drive and everything, I was told pretty much, you have to respect the cyclists. I actually had a situation where I was slowing down to make a right-hand turn and a cyclist just kind of appears out of my blind spot.
A transport truck was waiting to pass us, but unbeknownst to us, from behind the transport truck was this hot sports car that swerved right around and didn't know we were there, and so came in on a really fast pass and almost hit us.
I wanted to turn right. The light was green, so I moved ahead and was going to make the right turn, but I was kind of hoping that since the light was green, he would go ahead. But instead, I guess he thought I was cutting him off or something. And so he started smacking my car with his hand, pounded on the hood with his fist, and then he started swearing at me. I was trying to share the road. But it just kind of made me feel bad, and I kind of felt like I had been assaulted in a way, you know?
And, you know, I feel my heart bleeds for him when I hear someone gets killed, but it's their own fault at the end of the day.
Modern-day cities are the result of yesterday's planning decisions. And in North America, the overarching logic of yesterday was deference to the automobile. Communities were designed to accommodate the driver. The expectation was one of freedom, that you could drive anywhere, virtually any time, and find a parking spot, ideally a free one, when you get there. Question that, and you're questioning the status quo, our way of life.
The Great Void, the mid-20th century void, when everything was designed for the car, and that's all we designed for. So we trained engineers on how to do it safely and well. So they know how to do freeways, continental scale. They don't know how to do a curve on a bike lane.
Gordon Price is the director of Simon Fraser University's Cities Program. He's a former Vancouver City Councillor and an outspoken transportation advocate. Price has seen a trend over the past decade where that perspective, that myopic view on transportation freedom, has come increasingly under fire.
This idea that the car is the only real mode of transportation that offers people freedom is physical impossibility. Because if everybody uses one mode, and that would be true for cycling if it were as it is for cars, if everybody uses the same mode at the same time, that system fails. Because it can't handle the peak demands. And it congests up. And then there's no alternative, so all you can keep doing is trying to expand the system.
There's a more nuanced view of transportation emerging in city halls. One that considers many networks, all layered one over the other. Yes, a road network, but also a pedestrian network, a cycling network, a bus network, a rapid transit network, a walking network. Interwoven networks. For Price, that's what a city's all about. Choice. That's what he calls real freedom. But this shift is anything but straightforward. And change is anything but easy. Newton's first law of motion says that an object will keep right on moving until acted upon by an opposing force. And where that point of contact occurs, sparks fly. A flashpoint. And as this paradigm shift creeps into our city planning logic, some folks are going to extremes to make their opposition known.
When it came to this point, we were really, really excited. Like, this was like one of the big moments where it seemed like things were changing in Halifax.
The year was 2014. After several years of campaigning for a north-south cycling route, the city of Halifax decided to move forward with its first urban cycling project in years, a crosstown connector. A cycle lane that would stitch together opposite ends of the city's downtown peninsula. Matt Werona was involved firsthand in that push. He was a board member of Halifax's cycling advocacy group around the time the bike lane was installed.
So this was actually pretty huge, and we had this big celebration, we were giving out cake, and we were on the news for that, and there was excitement among the media around, oh, could Halifax be this cycling city? Like, it's almost poised to be there.
But not everyone was excited. Sacrifices had to be made to make room for the bike lane. Halifax City Council had voted to remove 70 parking spots along a busy business street, and a couple of local shops were calling foul.
There was one very, very vocal, very angry business about this bike lane. It was specific to no parking in front of his business, obviously because there was a bike lane now. And what ended up happening was there was kind of like this two-sided camp of there's this guy with a business and cyclists. So there was this this media mentality where it was, are cyclists killing business? Are they opposing forces? And are they at war?
One side saw the move as a campaign to support active transportation, while the other saw it as killing business. It was a battle for space, a road war. And in Halifax, that us versus them mentality ended up spilling out into the very streets the two sides were fighting over.
What ended up happening was there were reports online of these tacks you put into cork boards being kind of placed in the lane. Quite a few of them. I think one report was of 25 to 50 of them just along a long stretch of the bike lane, exactly where the bikes ride. And as you know, those kind of maybe quarter inch or half inch tacks can be really, really disastrous for a bike tire and basically get you to swerve into traffic or anything like that. So it was kind of, it made me think, like, there's no way this is someone actually putting tacks in or trying to harm people because the city put paint on the road. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. And I was at school at the time it was happening, and people were really interested in the story because it was like, oh, like, is this a war? And a friend of mine, the chair of the cycling coalition, he was just riding home from work, grabbed something to eat, and he decided, you know what, I'm gonna check this out. This is pretty close to my house. And I was like, okay, Ben, whatever. Like, you're not gonna find anything. Like, probably got swept off the road by now. And a couple of moments later, he gives me a call, and he was like, it's true. I have three tacks in my tire right now.
In the end, no charges were laid, and the tacks stopped showing up in the bike lane. But the Halifax story just goes to show how hotly contested these spaces are. Navigating the plethora of emotions on all sides of the multimodal spectrum is a key challenge facing the modern-day city.
You get into a certain crowd, and there's really, really, really big excitement about a bike lane, and then you realize that there's, like, a lot of people who don't understand, like, who don't get the value of that kind of infrastructure, who would never bike themselves, and therefore it shouldn't be there as infrastructure in the first place.
Cities must find a way to bridge those communities, to tell the right story. A story that encourages understanding streets as shared spaces. And it isn't a pie-in-the-sky ambition. It does exist. Just a hop, skip, and cycle away. Talk with cycling advocates, and you'll sometimes catch hushed whispers of a wondrous, magical place. A heavenly realm, referred to in tones of hushed reverence. A cycling nirvana, where millions are spent on cycling infrastructure, and virtually everyone bikes. The Netherlands. According to surveys, nearly a third of the Dutch population consider cycling their primary mode of transportation. Virtually no one wears a helmet. But thanks to the thriving cycle culture and unrivaled infrastructure, fewer than 50 fatal accidents occur for every billion kilometers cycled. When it comes to cycling infrastructure, the Dutch are anything but spendthrift. They dole out on average $50 a year for every person in the country. That's compared with $4 per person in Ontario. But this wasn't always the case. We catch up with the director of the Urban Cycling Institute in Amsterdam. Marcoot Brummelstroot discusses the confluence of forces that transformed the Netherlands into a multimodal metropolis.
As elsewhere, we were developing in terms of infrastructure and land use system, we were developing a car-based system in the Netherlands. So after 45, at the end of the war, we saw, I think, an annual decline of cycling of about 4 to 5% annually until the early 70s. And this was also the period that we developed completely new urban settlements, the new towns. We were actually traveling to Canada and New York and inviting engineers from there to help us getting this new innovation, the car, into our cities.
Cue the 1970s. Oil crisis. And a growing social movement opposing the suburban approach to city planning, of detached suburbs set apart from city centers.
Basically, I think the main driver for these movements were the social unrest, the idea that social housing was destroyed and market housing came back for it, so that poor people were pushed out of the city. That came all together in the early 70s, 1974, it's what is called in Amsterdam the Nieuwmarkt Rellen, the Nieuwmarkt riots, which we see as the only worldwide riots that combine land use and mobility issues. Yeah, so we really should be very happy with these people that were on the barricades 74, fighting for this against the engineers. It was not the engineers that had this light bulb moment. It was really physical urban warfare where tanks and the army came into Amsterdam to fight at the Nieuwmarkt with citizens. And they won. They resisted and they won. So that, thanks to these people, we have the city that actually now planners from the U.S. come to see how it should be done.
In the aftermath, city planners and engineers began adopting a different approach to urban design. Human-scaled infrastructure, compact neighborhoods, walkable communities. Buzzwords for a new planning order. And the car slowly dropped from its top spot. But designing a more multimodal city involves far more than installing a cycle lane.
Only the bicycle paths would never have created the bicycle culture that we know today if you don't look at the fine-grained land use system that also at the same time was developed. It's much more complex than any single expert could oversee. So it's not only building the bicycle paths that were built, but at the same time we had this idea that large parts of cities should be 30 kilometers per hour zones, which is also an essential element of it. We had in the Netherlands what was later called WoonF, the WoonF interventions, places in the city where the cars guessed. But at the same time, it was, if you look back now, it was much more complex. The fact that we made it impossible to build big box retail outside of the city, next to the highways, which means that we have a lot of small supermarkets still in every Dutch city, which makes the average distance towards supermarkets much lower. So the message for planners is that it's not something simple that you can copy. It's not something that you can engineer. It's a very complex system, a very complex ecosystem almost of all kinds of developments that were reinforcing each other without in the Netherlands at least, without a clear strategic overview.
Talked mostly about bikes versus cars conflict, but this next story shows that conflict in the public sphere can spill over into the unlikeliest of places.
I found myself in Elmwood, Illinois, I believe. I was in Chicago for a conference and called one of the aldermen who said, you know, in all my years of being in politics, this was the one issue I didn't expect to divide our community so much.
Mitra Kalita is the executive editor of the online business publication Quartz, based in New York, and author of Suburban Sahibs. While at a builders' conference in Florida, Mitra stumbled across something peculiar that builders were noticing across the country. After the 2008 crash, the old-style, cookie-cutter homes in the suburbs suddenly became a whole lot more affordable, and a lot of young people were taking advantage of the situation. But as they moved into their new neighborhoods, they brought urban aspirations with them.
Essentially retrofitting McMansion communities to be much more urban. And so one example that was used was that we built a lot of these places without sidewalks, thinking, you know, people would wheel their baby carriages on the street or walk their dogs on the street. They weren't high traffic areas. And now there's just a desire for a lot more connectivity with the outside world besides your car.
They wanted to make it easier to walk around their communities, to urbanize them. But not everyone was on board with this idea. Least of all, community members who had been there for years. Back to Chicago. Mitra heard the news from a city councilor that a sidewalk was becoming the unexpected flashpoint for community conflict.
And so I immediately took a cab and went to see the sidewalk that was in question, which was essentially a neighborhood where one side was older houses, the other side were the teardowns, you know, sort of more of your McMansions, if you will. And it was on the new side that a sidewalk had been installed, and then suddenly it comes to an older house and it just stops.
She decided to speak with residents on both sides of the street. Pretty soon, it became clear that there were two main narratives happening.
People my parents' age said, this is the way it's always been. You know, if you want to walk somewhere, you just walk in the street. Nobody really does. You know, there's no stores near us, so where are they going? And then the younger families were like, you know, we want our kids to be able to walk to school. We want to be able to stroll a baby carriage and not worry about a car coming down the road. And they just wanted much more of a feel of urban America in what was a very clear suburb. Some of it actually wasn't as much opposition to the sidewalks, but really opposition to teardowns. So there was a hint of these people came in, they changed the character of our neighborhood, they changed the character of the housing, and now they want to impose this concrete strip on. You know, why can't their kids just play in the driveway? You're just what I needed.
You're just what I needed. The jury is still out in Elmwood, Illinois. But clearly, the conflict over public space goes beyond bikes and cars. Planners say if you build it, then they will come. But getting it built's easier said than done. Takes political will, persistence the most. This tale from Toronto? Well, it has both. Here in Canada, it's still early days for our bike culture. Cycling is still mostly viewed as a niche activity. For urban daredevils in spandex, or off-road adventurers. Yeehaw! An image and a perception that continues to hamstring our nation's bicycle advocates. Forward-thinking policymakers are positioning cycling as part of an integrated network. Transportation decisions are controversial and capital-intensive. They need political champions willing to see beyond the collateral damage. Sometimes it's about inviting someone to ride a mile in your shoes, even when that someone is the mayor of Canada's largest city.
My name's Jared Kolb, and I'm executive director of Cycle Toronto.
In advance of last year's mayoral election in Toronto, the city's biggest cycling advocacy organization was working hard to make cycling part of the discussion. Cycle Toronto launched a campaign called Minimum Grid. It called for a 100-kilometer network of protected bike lanes by 2018. But the frontrunner for mayor, John Tory, was quickly turning into an anti-bike candidate. So Jared and the Cycle Toronto team decided to take Tory on a little ride around their city. Here's Jared.
I got a phone call from the campaign manager, Tom Allison. He was like, is this Cycle Toronto? And I'm like, yeah, hey, my name's Jared. I said, is this the group that's calling John Tory the anti-bike candidate? I was like, yeah. Okay, well, I've only got one more question. And it's either going to lead to a bunch more questions or this conversation is over. is this a personal attack on John, or are you just trying to get our attention? And I was like, yeah, Tom, we're just trying to get your attention. He's like, good, you've got it. What do you want? The next day, we got another call from this campaign manager, Tom Allison, to say, Jared, we want to set up a bike ride with John. For you and for John Tory, you know, to go out, to, you know, check out city streets. John hasn't ridden in the downtown core, and he has not been on a bike in 5 or 6 years. But with that said, don't go easy on him. Show him what it's like to be a cyclist in this city. This is not a media opportunity. We're not sending out any media about this. This is a fact-finding mission for John. Okay, this could be cool. So we set it up.
So Jared and the mayoral hopeful headed downtown to explore the city's busiest bike routes at rush hour.
We started easy. We started on the Shaw Street bikeway. We started there, and then we went down to Harvard, which is another really busy cycling street. This was all during rush hour. At Harvard and Spadina, it is a very heavy bicycle corridor in this city. Lots of bike traffic. And John was stunned. He'd never seen anything like it before. And this is just it, right? Like, for car drivers or for transit users, you're accustomed. If you're a car driver, you're accustomed to seeing traffic. Mm-hmm. You're accustomed to seeing car traffic. You're not paying attention necessarily to other road users. We were standing at that corner, and, you know, there are just wave after wave of you know, bicycles passing us. John was floored. We went down to college, witnessed the same thing. I took him on Spadina, which is a fairly tough road to ride. We went down to Adelaide, and the new cycle tracks had just started to be installed. The lane was there, the bollards weren't. And reminder, of course, this was the lanes that he opposed. And we rode along those, felt fairly comfortable. They came to an end, though, just before university, and we crossed over to university. And it was at that point that John was almost doored. A car door opened. He had to swerve. We pulled over immediately afterwards. You know, he was like, I've never experienced anything like that. My life flashed before my eyes right there. That was wild.
The soon-to-be mayor got to share that harrowing urban cyclist experience. He saw firsthand just how many people are using cycling as part of their multimodal mix. Tory went to win the election, and while Toronto didn't transform overnight into a cycling mecca, soon enough signs started cropping up that the new mayor was thinking differently about cycling in Hogtown.
To our surprise, John attended an opening of the Richmond-Adelaide pilot project, and he talked to the media, and he talked about why he was so supportive of the pilot project. And he also, a month and a half later, released a bike policy.
How could I forget to mention the bicycle is a good invention?
A simple gesture, but a powerful one, that shows just how impactful a little empathy building can be.
So how could I forget to mention the bicycle? Somebody told the world.
Even the self-proclaimed greenest city in the world has its own struggles with the transportation shift. Vancouver. The West Coast city was the setting for one of the country's most high-profile standoffs between cyclists and drivers. In 2014, after several years of planning and public engagement, Vancouver City Council was put to the test. The city wanted to install a cycling corridor that would run through the western part of Vancouver, known as Point Grey. The 5-kilometer corridor would fix a major gap in the city's otherwise seamless 28-kilometer cycling network, weaving together protected lanes, multi-use paths, and bike boulevards. But the city would be faced with maintaining political will in the face of a strong opposition from the affluent neighborhood.
It was not surprising at all that something like Point Grey Road would be a flashpoint, because here was just going beyond begrudgingly allocating some space. This was taking the space.
That's Gordon Price again.
Point Grey Road was closed. A gated community would be restored to all Vancouverites if they were elected. And you said, well, you know, you can still drive there. That wasn't what it was about. It was that it wasn't a through street.
The Point Grey project proposed transforming one standard residential street in this Tony Vancouver neighborhood into an integrated cycling corridor. The plan would see a series of different traffic calming treatments designed to redirect through traffic to adjacent streets and give priority to bikes. But the plan proved a tall order. There was immense pushback in the lead-up to the street closure. But in the aftermath, the move has turned out to be an unprecedented success. It's been 1 year since the bike lane was installed on Point Grey Road. The City of Vancouver recently checked on the impact of the lane. Bike use has grown dramatically. Before, midweek cycling traffic was 600 cyclists a day. Immediately after, the midweek count now shows 1,500 people cycling. That's a 150% increase. In August, the midweek count ballooned to 2,700, with a peak weekend day of 3,300, or a 450% jump, making it busier than many other popular downtown routes. Point Grey followed a similar effort in 2009. Council voted to temporarily install protected bike lanes on the Burrard Bridge in downtown Vancouver. Gordon Price talks about the firestorm in the lead-up to the bike lane trial and the underlying forces that polarize these debates.
And the media fully expected that the consequences would be Carmageddon. There were helicopters waiting, broadcast the backups, live coverage, I mean, right there on Burrard Street. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. Same thing with Point Grey Road. 10,000 cars are going to have to be shifted. Of course it's going to have consequences. And that's what happens. You don't stop the traffic, it just moves. It's going to be Carmageddon. We did it. And what happened? Nothing. Nothing happened. And then you could see that really what was going on here was a fundamental questioning of the assumptions upon which our cities and our way of life has been built for about at least the last half century, arguably for most of the 20th century. Now, you would think that would be huge. It is huge. It's actually really significant. Do you remember seeing the headlines or the coverage? Have you seen the backstory? Have you seen the revision of opinions? No. And if someone proposes it again, we will go through the same thing, because it's not about the bike lane. It's about all of these other issues.
The safest of all, I can lock on my doors. It's the only way to live in cars.
Despite its challenges, Vancouver is a destination for planners and city builders to see new ideas in action. However, Seattle is also getting noticed for something as simple as messaging. They say, if you don't like what is being said, change the conversation.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
In 2014, the City of Seattle greenlighted a simple repaving project. The street? A minor business route near the University of Washington. Simple, straightforward, without opposition. But a community advocacy group called University Greenways decided to make a special request. Kathy Tuttle is the head of Seattle Neighborhood Greenways. She tells the story of what happened next.
So University Greenways had approached the City of Seattle to ask if a repaving project could add protected bike lanes to that repaving project. And the city said, no, it's just a repaving project. We don't want it to happen here. But the University Greenways members said, we really want this because so many people are traveling to the university by bicycle. We think it's a very safe way for the people who are going to the university to go by bicycle. And the city came back and said, no, there are too many businesses along this street, and you know they're not going to want protected bike lanes on the street.
They were at a crossroads. Give up? Or up the ante? Gather petitions? Organize a rally? A critical mass ride? Criticize the supposed business opposition? Instead, members of the group decided to reach out and chat with business owners along the proposed bike route.
They came in as not people who were bicycle riders, but people who were their neighbors, people who were their customers, and they approached them and said, I'm a person who shops at your grocery store, or I'm a person that, you know me, I buy flowers from your flower shop, and I ride a bicycle, and I would really like a bicycle route on this lane that would be a protected bike lane. It's such a different conversation when you say that, rather than, as a cyclist, I want to see a bike rack out front.
And it worked. Most business owners jumped on board. It was transformative. Instead of cyclists versus businesses, the discussion centered around people. People who bike and people who drive. People who shop and people who own shops.
It was something that was done respectfully and person to person, business, owner to customer. But it was huge. It was a huge win that really came through this language and through this way of talking to people.
The Seattle situation highlights the power of language. How the way we use words can have a profound effect on how we relate to one another, promote community and civility, and design our cities.
I think that we forget sometimes when we segment ourselves into these kind of advocacy groups that are about one single element, or, we're just about housing, or we're just about transit, or we're just about the new light rail line, or something like that. And we forget that what we're building is our habitat. It's that kind of messaging that just is transformative of the whole conversation. People see you as another person with a legitimate need, as a person who bikes or as a person who walks. The response of business owners, of other community members, of government officials is just entirely different when you approach people one-on-one as a person to another person.
Cities are ultimately about people. And as people, we get up to a heck of a lot of things. We bike and we drive. We walk, shop, and sightsee. We eat out. We visit museums and art galleries. We skateboard, we suntan, we garden. And the majority of us do some or all of these things in one setting in particular.
We are people who live in cities, and we need cities to work for us. We need cities that, are spiritually uplifting. We need cities that are fun. We need cities that are good for children. We need cities where we feel comfortable. We need cities that belong to us.
Haven't got a Cadillac or a big Oldsmobile. Just a little guy, not a big time wheel. But I can't prove that my love is true on my rocking bicycle that's a bill for two. We don't care.
You've been listening to Cities Alive, the podcast, bringing the city to life with stories. Cities Alive is a Planning and Design Center production, created and produced by Danielle Davis, Jordan Omond, and me, Ross Soward. Thanks to our European correspondent, Lucas Brailsford. Funding support for Road Wars was provided by the Nova Scotia Moves Program and the Canadian Institute of Planners. For more Cities Alive episodes, subscribe to Cities Alive on iTunes or stream Cities Alive at pdcenter.ca.
Well, we don't care if we're a little out of date. We don't care if we're a little bit late. We're gonna
Cities Alive is a Planning and Design Center production. Created and produced by Danielle Davis, Jordan Omond, and me, Ross Soward. I guess I didn't need to say that part. Okay, bye. Thank you.